outstanding individuals in terms of accomplishments in their own communities are Kenny Grander and Alan Senior. Kenny has his background from Yeshiva and Seminar, and also from the famed Lincoln Square Synagogue in Manhattan, and his involvement there, and more recently in Book of Tongues, and there are literally hundreds and hundreds of people who are involved in learning programs and have been attracted to his activities in Boca. And Alan Senior, excuse me, is in Columbus and has been there for a number of years and has taken a dying synagogue and made it into the one of the most dynamic synagogues in all of the country. Hundreds of people have committed themselves to mitzvahs. He has shiurim in interesting places in the city and has attracted the types of people that we have to attract. And I would say in both of their cases, the chomer is what is attractive. And I would say in both of their cases, the chomer is what is attracted, but it's also the power of the personality and how they've been able to garner their personal strengths to be able to have impact on other individuals. It's really a pleasure to have the privilege to introduce them. We're going to first hear from Kenny Grander and then Rabbi Senior afterwards, and then maybe after both of those presentations, we'll have questions. Rabbi Grander.
First of all, I'd like to thank Ruben for his warm introduction, and also thank Rabbinic Alumni for inviting me to say a few words, because I believe that when we, not only when we hear shiurim from Rosh Yeshiva on important contemporary issues, but when we share ideas both in an informal and a formal fashion with other chaverim, it creates the opportunity, at least I know myself, that after each one of these conferences, I walk away and reevaluate my goals and my agendas for my community. And hopefully through these conferences, we are all empowered to be more effective ambassadors of Torah to our extended community. What my agenda for the few minutes I'm going to speak is really not to focus that much on what I'm doing in my synagogue, but really what I think is a vision for a synagogue. I'd like to articulate a certain philosophy. I don't think I'm going to be machadish anything, but perhaps organize it a little bit differently. You know that after Moshe Rabbeinu completes the Mishkan, at the apex of their excitement, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has one more request. And that is, before Moshe dedicates the Mishkan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants Moshe to take apart the Mishkan and put it back together again for 7 days. Now why is that? Here's a man, 80-something years old. He is not going to be responsible to do that. That's the responsibility of Levium. Nevertheless, God says, before you consecrate this tabernacle, do one thing for me. Take it apart in front of the eyes of the Jewish people and put it back together again for an entire week. And I believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to communicate a message to the Jewish people to tell them that the difference between a golden calf and a golden temple is that these people looked at the golden calf as a end in itself, and they have to realize that this tabernacle is not an end in itself, but it is a means to an end, to create sacred moments in time with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore God says, listen, before they make this mistake again and think that this is a vehicle, is an end in itself, at this moment where the invitations for the dedication have been sent out, you know, and everyone's all psyched and they've reserved the day, take it apart in front of their eyes and let them realize that it's not really the structure, the edifice itself that is important, but rather what can happen through the structure. That through the structure we can have a transformation of the Jew from a climate of estrangement to a spirit of ecstasy and intimacy. And indeed, we all know that the halachas of a shul, Kedushat Beis Knesset, really originate from Kedushat HaMishkan and Kedushat HaMikdash. And therefore, it's important for us to understand what the Beis HaMikdash and what the Mishkan really was all about. The Beis HaMikdash was not just the house of prayer. It hosted a spectrum of experiences. emotional as well as intellectual. It was there that you had the famous Simchas Beis HaShoeva. It was there that mourners were comforted. It was there that marriage was celebrated. It was the residence of the court, and there was a Beit Midrash. And if our synagogues are to be viewed, as indeed they are in the Talmud, as a Mikdash Ma'at, then we must realize that our synagogues must also be a host to an arena of experiences. And therefore, there are the meat and potato things that we all know a shul is supposed to do. It's supposed to be there to service our congregants in times of tragedy, in times of triumph. We know that our youth must feel comfortable in the synagogue. We know that both the prince of the synagogue and the pauper of the synagogue must use the synagogue to search out the Spirit of God. But what do you do with those individuals that are regular minyan goers, or regular participants in the synagogue? Now that you have them in your grasp, how do you guarantee that just like the Mikdash was a place where a Jew could grow from strength to strength, that you have this Mikdash Ma'at that allows your congregants to grow from strength to strength? And I believe that what we have to do is we have to empower the membership. We have to create opportunities for them to study. And that can be done in many different ways. And many of the ideas that I'm about to recite are not my own. They're really ideas that I worked on. They weren't my own then. I just had the good fortune of having good people with me at Lincoln Square and at Boca Raton Synagogue. And first it is to create certain programs like a tshuva campaign. Before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, people are beginning to think about tshuva, to find ways to look at your membership, look at a membership list, like Jesse was, similar to what Jesse was saying yesterday, and evaluate what are the needs of your congregants. And then classify those needs in terms of classes. And then after Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, make sure there's also a series of classes which can guarantee that they can grow in their own spiritual development. For some, it might be classes in Gemara. For others, it might be classes in contemporary halakha. For most, it should be at least classes in Tanakh. But we must look at our membership, those that are coming already, and look at what we think that they need. And it is not only important to figure out what classes they need, but also where is the most appropriate theater of experience, where is the most appropriate arena that these classes can happen. Sometimes it's important that the class happen in the synagogue, but many times it's important that the class happen at someone's home. If I'm going to have a class in someone's home, then not only will that person come to the class, but all his or her friends will also come to the class. It's a way of attracting a certain group of membership. You know, we all have cliques within our membership. And sometimes it's important to try to get those cliques to come together not only to socialize and to schmooze, but also to learn together. So perhaps it's important that we move some of our classes outside the synagogue arena and move them into homes. I think it's also important that we introduce our congregants not only to us as scholars, but also to other rabbis. And I'm a strong advocate in the scholar in residence program. 3 or 4 times a year, there are scholars that come down from all Florida. It's very easy to attract, especially during the winter, people to come down. But like in 3 weeks from now, we will be having Adin Steinsaltz as a scholar in residence. And last year we had Saul Berman and J.J. Schachter and Shlomo Riskin. Each took 1 week and was scholar in residence. And I think it's very important because it creates a broader spectrum to the congregants of what Torah is all about. Each of them have different approaches. Each of them have different personalities. And you get together with a luncheon and a dinner and Sudash Shlishit, and you expose your congregants to different personalities. They understand that what your hashkafa is not a... Your hashkafa was not created in a vacuum, but there are personalities from around the country, or indeed around the world, that share similar hashkafas. I think it gives a more broader perspective on your approach in life. Indeed, empowering your membership to study Torah doesn't only mean that they should give classes, that you should give classes, but it means that they should teach also. And I have worked towards creating at Sudash Lishit that the rabbi does not give the Dvar Torah, but either women, or you will allow men also, to give the Dvar Torah, so that they study, so that they prepare. And quite often, it might not be the most dynamic or the most moving Dvar Torah, But what happens is that people are excited because their peers are teaching each other. We have a woman's study group that meets every Shabbos Mevarchim, and somebody else prepares. And sometimes it takes me longer to help that person prepare than it would if I gave the shiur myself. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to empower others, not only to come to classes, but to also to be able to teach others. And there's another type of learning that I think we should be involved in, and that is creating chavrutot. We have dedicated Thursday nights in my shul to turning the shul into a beis medrash, where there is not the formal lecture type of learning, but rather tutorials, and we use people perhaps who have more advanced learning to go around and be like a shul meshiv. But there is an interchange between two people. And although, once again, that might not be the most greatest Chidushei Torah emanate from those studies, but when two people sharpen each other, not only do you intensify relationships, but you open up people to what the love of learning is all about. And there are motivators. Lincoln Square had a beautiful project, and that is that Nila Night, and I do this in Boca Raton Synagogue. We give out a pamphlet that says Rabbi Brander is about to ask you to make a commitment that won't cost you a penny, and it opens up and it asks you to pledge to learn a certain amount of hours a year for Ni'ilah. Then you go home hopefully that night, and maybe 30% of the membership will respond. And the same way you send them out a bill for their pledges, you send them out a bill for the amount of hours that they agreed to learn. Or at Simchas Torah, instead of auctioning off Ataresa for money, auction off Ataresa for hours of learning. And then there are groups that come together and agree to learn 10,000 hours. You get everybody to agree to learn, or you do one pasuk for the community and you get everyone to agree to do 10 hours for the whole year. It's not a tremendous amount of time, and if you want to increase your morning minyan, you can even allow minyan to count as 1 hour. But it is a way in which to empower the membership to become part of the learning process. So I think there's one important point, and that is to create an arena of experiences, just like the Beit HaMikdash was, for those that we already have within our midst. But I think it would be foolish for us to end the process there. And that is that while we realize we have a responsibility to inreach, we must also realize that we have a responsibility to reach out. And that while it has been proven through many different statistics that traditional ideals of Torah and people bonding to them connect will guarantee the future of the people, and that Jewish identity just by a JCC or many people being involved in a branch of Judaism that is built on compromises and concessions will not guarantee the future, the eternality of the Jewish people, we must understand that if it's true that the Jewish people's future is based on their connection to a traditional way of life, and an orthodoxy has been vindicated for its ideological firmness, then we have a responsibility to reach out. And if we really believe that orthodoxy is genuine, then we must not recoil into seclusion, but rather we must be selfless. And if we really are secure with our convictions that orthodoxy is an appropriate lifestyle for everybody, then we must not be frightened to perform the mitzvah of Avas Yisrael. And the synagogue has to be open, it has to be advertised as open to every Jew who wishes to be called a Jew, who's proud to be called a Jew, no matter how enormous his or her ignorance or how distasteful his or her heresy. I remember Rabbi Lam once saying that imagine instead of the Orthodox community just being viewed as firm, they'd be viewed as friendly. Instead of being viewed just as right, they'd be viewed as accessible. Instead of criticizing in smugness, they would do it in sadness. And when we would disagree, we would do it agreeably. Then we would not only be right, but we would also be lovable. And I think that we have to project an idea that we have to be tolerant, but without any compromise. And it's extremely important that we extend ourselves to the outer community. And there are several different programs, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The National Jewish Outreach Program has a crash course in Hebrew reading, has a Turn Friday Night into Shabbos program, has explanatory services, and has all the materials necessary to teach any rabbi or any lay person how to develop these types of programs. We have to create study groups for those which Judaism is new to. We have to create women's classes for them. We have to get our members involved. You know, there was a hurricane that hit South Florida. And one of the things that we did was, around 4 days after the hurricane, thank God Boca was not really hit that bad. I mean, people maybe had a few $100 worth of damage, but in comparison to what there is in Kendall and Homestead, you know, it was we only had 90 mile an hour winds. They had, 150 or 160 mile an hour winds. And what it did was, 3 or 4 days afterwards, we sent down to the Young Israel Kendall around 600 pounds of dry ice and everything else that they needed. And we extended ourselves, the synagogue extended itself to a larger community. And people began to realize that an Orthodox shul does not only mean coming to davening. An Orthodox shul means that you are community action based. An Orthodox shul means that you care not only about yourself, but you care about others also. And I'm saying that there is a stereotype out there that quite often orthodoxy means that there's a certain recoiling and removal from the entire Weltanschauung of the community. And it's not an oxymoron to want to build a synagogue which houses a kollel and is a mecca of scholarship and still be a center of outreach. It's possible to do both. Now, I'm very fortunate that in my community, the Reform and Conservative rabbis came to me a few months ago and asked me to run the Vada Kashrus. And while there were many Orthodox people that were very upset about it because I forbid certain types of meat and there was financial loss for certain Orthodox rabbis in the process, the Conservative and Reform rabbis, they were very excited about it. And the reason why they came to me, I asked them, why are you coming to me? You know that my standards are going to be different than yours. You know it's going to cost the community literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to kosher the Federation. And they said, because finally we have a rabbi who's Orthodox, who we understand is not exclusive, but it tries to include everybody. And at the same time, we're building a new shul and a mikvah. And they came to me and they said, we'd like to be able to use the mikvah for conversions. And we'll pay for the mikvah if we can use the mikvah conversion. That's a $250,000 cost they're willing to pay for, and they have more than enough money to pay for it. And I said, no thank you, I cannot, you know, I can't do that. But what I did was, I closed the mikvah for all conversions, even Orthodox conversions. So that once again, the mikvah did not become a flag of dissension within the community. And even though they're not willing to pay for the mikvah from that perspective, but at least, you know, it created a certain understanding that I'm not willing to compromise my principles, but I'm willing to be tolerant. And ultimately, if you want to extend yourself to the broader community and bring in people into your synagogue, then ultimately you have to be willing to do things of that nature. I'd like to conclude just with one more Dvar Torah. You know, when Moshe consecrates this Mishkan, which represents this arena of experiences, the vessel that's used to formalize the consecration is the Mizbeach. And the Mizbeach symbolizes all throughout Midrashic and Kabbalistic literature the uncompromising willingness to sacrifice on behalf of God. And we say in Hashemoneh Esrei, the Yishei Yisrael and the fires of Israel, which Tosfos explains doesn't only mean the literal sacrifices, but it means the martyrdom, both in good times and the financial loss and the loss of job security, and the martyrdom, the literal martyrdom in bad times, the willingness for us to ascend the ramp in our relationship to God. But what's very interesting is that the altar is not complete in the Mishkan until the censers of Korach, the machtos of Korach, are attached to the altar. Why should it be that the machtot of Korach, these censers, which represent the rebellion against Knesset Yisrael and against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why should they be part of the altar which represents our constant and consistent sacrifice to God? And I believe that the answer is that the true altar is, if it is going to be an instrument of ascension to God, must not only symbolize perseverance and success, but also failure. Because with commitment comes challenge. And challenges are filled with struggles, with setbacks, and with failures. And we have to understand that when we build a synagogue and we want to reach out and we want to create opportunities for our own membership to grow, and we want them to ascend this Mizbeach, we have to understand that sometimes we will fail in the process. Sometimes a good program on paper with the slick advertising and with the great paper or whatever, folded the right way or whatever you want to say, and you get 60 advisors to tell you what to do, it'll still might fail. But you cannot forget the message of the Mizbeach, that sometimes there are failures within the process. But the ultimate understanding of the Mizbeach and the ultimate goal of the Mizbeach is to still want to ascend that ramp even when we fail. And if you're not willing to fail when you extend yourselves to the outside community, when you extend yourselves to your own membership, then you'll never be successful. You have to realize that when you want to extend yourself to your own membership, and when you want to extend yourself to the outer community, and when you want to take this Jewish challenge, and when you want to ascend the altar, you have to realize that in the process there might be times that you will pull back. But ultimately the message of the altar, of this instrument of accession to God, is that yes, sometimes you fail, but through perseverance we guarantee not only that our community will grow from strength to strength, but we create a blueprint of what a synagogue should be, which will not only affect our community, but create standards for the entire American Jewish community. Thank you. After Alan speaks, I have prepared some just handouts, if someone wants, of some of the programs. And feel free to use anything that you want without, you know, there's no need to give credit. The purpose of this material is just for people to take anything they want, use it in any way you feel most comfortable, so that you can, you know, help your own synagogue.
Yeah, very good.
Yashar kochacha. I as well would like to thank Reuven for his very gracious remarks, as well as the administration of Yeshiva University for giving me the opportunity to address you this morning. 2 years ago, I attended the OU annual dinner. I'm not sure that's going to work. Are you going? As you can tell, I'm not technical. I have to think I transcend that experience. Neither was recorded for microphones. 2 years ago, I attended the OU annual dinner. One of my Baal Batim was being honored, and therefore I was a participant in the event. I saw folks there from the White Shul who knew me as a little boy growing up in Far Rockaway. Associating my Rabbonis in Columbus with the honoree of the evening, one of them came over to me, and in a manner that seemed so smug, perhaps I'm spoiled, I no longer live in New York, and I'm not used to the style of New Yorkers, he came over to me and he said, with his arms folded, "So, Alan, what kind of Jews are there in Columbus, Ohio?" Somewhat put off by the question, I nevertheless answered. My immediate response was one word: growing. And in fact, that was the best answer that I could have given. That best describes the congregants that are mine. They are all growing. And I thought to myself, shouldn't we all be growing? Rabbi, synagogue, and congregant alike. Isn't that shot in the pasuk, Lo Sava v'maros ha-mizbechi, that when one goes up to the Mizbeach, as one comes closer to the Ribono Shel Olam, steps are inappropriate and self-defeating. With steps, one's spiritual growth is limited, for one can remain on any given step for an entire lifetime. But if there's an incline, there's no such thing as standing still. One either moves forward or falls back. And that is the pshat in the pasuk. As you come closer to the Mizbeach, as you continue to grow, keep moving. My image, I used to go ice skating in Long Beach when I was a child, and I always remember the sign that said, keep moving, which I did, I keep moving. As you come closer to the Mizbeach, as you continue to grow, keep moving. Move on towards greater heights, towards greater spiritual achievements. The challenge of the contemporary synagogue must be one of losala v'malo samizvachi. The shul must be a place committed to the spiritual growth of its congregants. Concurrent with this, of course, there must be a mandate for growth for the institution and the Rav as well. We must never forget that. There are three categories that might best describe the mode of spiritual expression of the synagogue. The first is the synagogue designed to reflect the holiness of the community. In fact, is established as a result of individuals achieving a certain level of kedusha. It is then that a synagogue becomes appropriate and relevant to their lives. Of course, the classical example of this is the reason for Parshas Truma coming after Yisroel and Mishpatim. It is only after Kabbalat HaTorah, as well as the elaborate formulation of civil law and social justice, that it is shayach to speak of a Mishkan. After Bnei Yisrael achieve the Madrega of Kedusha, can a Mishkan become meaningful and purposeful in their lives? The second category of synagogues is the one in which the institution becomes a substitute for its constituents. Rather than Yahadus being a living reality in the lives of the people, the synagogue and its rabbinic leadership do everything on behalf of the congregants. Surrogate in nature, they become the people's emissary to God. In such synagogues, the status quo is maintained, with the shul becoming the center for life cycle events and rites of passage. Overall maintenance becomes the identifying characteristic. The third category is the synagogue that neither reflects the kedusha of the community, neither becomes a substitute for Jewish living, but is the source for kedusha in the lives of its members. The synagogue becomes an exciting wellspring, serving as a centripetal force, dynamic and filled with energy, affecting congregants as well as the community at large. The synagogue does not take its cue from the community, but rather sets the tone, thus becoming the vehicle for spiritual and halachic growth. With this in mind, perhaps we can see the godless of Abraham over Noach. The pasuk indicates, Et ha'okim hisharech Noach, Noach walks with his God, pious though he may be, he is self-contained. Of Abraham, the pasuk writes, Hisharech upanai v'hiyeh tamim. Abraham walks before God, a figure, I might say, in perpetual spiritual motion, always moving forward, creating the setting for and vehicle through which Kedusha becomes an integral part of the lives of the people of Haran. Abraham, like the third category of synagogues, becomes the source for all that is holy. How does the contemporary synagogue become the source for Kedusha, the vehicle for spiritual growth? I believe this, b'chol levavi, b'chol nafshi, that the challenge lies with the gavra, the individual, the rav. It's a tremendous upright. It ought to humble all of us when we think of what we do and the challenges that arise. But it lies with the gavra, with the individual, with the rav. Perhaps with good reason, the Beit HaMikdash was called Beit Shlomo, for it was Shlomo HaMelech, the gavra, the individual who gave to it its capacity to serve in Israel in such a spiritual way, thus becoming the source of Kedusha. After Shlomo HaMelech, for many years, the Beit HaMikdash fell into physical and spiritual disrepair, wasn't until Yoshiyahu that it attained its importance once again. It becomes the apprentice of the individual of Yoshiyahu to rededicate the Beit HaMikdash to its former chashivas. The Rav in the synagogue of the 1990s must do likewise. Let me tell you briefly about the synagogue that I serve in Columbus, Ohio. This, I must admit, is the most difficult part of my talk. Perhaps you will understand what I mean in light of the following. Last year, Rabbi Tunka Stolper, who has been to our synagogue for Shabbat, spoke to me about writing an article for Jewish Action, highlighting the many things and exciting things that are going on in Agudas Achim. I declined because I felt that though there was much to tell, it would seem self-serving and self-flattering. Something my Lichtish mother always taught me is worthless. However, it is a story that should be told, and I appreciate the opportunity, difficult though it is, to tell it this morning. A story that very much is consistent with the theme of the session, as well as the remarks that I've said until now. A story that very much shows how a synagogue can become a vehicle for spiritual and halakhic growth, radically changing the lives of its members. When I first came to Agudas Achim a little over 9 years ago, it was a congregation that was rapidly losing its reputation as a significant force in the community. Its membership had started to dwindle. Not only were members leaving, but it no longer was an option for attracting new people. Its membership was old. On Shabbos, perhaps 70 people were in attendance, and I brought the mean age down to 92. Its educational programs were almost non-existent. Little was offered in the form of shiurim. There were almost no Shomer Shabbat. Kosher homes were becoming fewer and fewer, and Taras HaMishpacha had become a thing of the past. I took on the challenge, and Baruch Hashem, with what I believe to be overwhelming Sayata Divishmaya, the potential for transformation and growth has taken place. Shiurim abound. The Lunch with a Rabbi downtown series that I started for professionals and businessmen gained national recognition, for it attracts more than 70 young people who come together midday during the week to study Torah. A Chumash and Mefarshim and breakfast class held downtown draws an age group, men and women in their 20s, that counters the Federation's statistics that claim synagogues are not successfully reaching out to this target group. Where there were no NCSY chapters, Baruch Hashem, we now have a senior, junior, and sophomore group, the largest in the region, with our hosting a Shabbaton last year that featured Rabbi Moshe Tendler as the keynote speaker. This past summer, we hosted a mini kollel transforming our library into a Beit Medrash for yeshiva students and congregants alike. The Brachim came from Mary Israel and Rabbi Swice Yeshiva in Miami. Shavuos night, we're up all night with the Hashkama Meninas on. Not only have we reversed the trend of people leaving the ranks of membership, but many of our new young members are coming from the conservative and reformed congregations, with the net result of Yayin Hara of more than 600 new members joining since I've arrived, with a total membership of almost 900. And again, I say this not to flatter myself, but to say that with the help of the Rabbanu Shalom, things can happen. Couples whose grandparents ceased keeping kosher are now starting to kosher their homes, with a desire to be correct in the most exacting of ways. It even drives someone who's as obsessive as myself almost crazy. They've added meaning to the word, but it's wonderful. They want to know every halakha. There's some adapting. couples are buying homes near the shul so that they can walk on Shabbos. Alternate Shabbos services have been instituted to meet the varied needs of our ever-growing and diverse membership. And an ordinary Shabbos without a simcha, 350 to 400 join together for davening in the main sanctuary. Women are starting to go to mitzvah, and several married women, after reviewing the halachos with me, are now starting to cover the hair. I remember when I was first interviewed, I must admit I was hesitant. And then I thought of the words of Rav Kook Zatzal, so simple and yet so profound. Bo yavo, bo yavo, it shall come. And Baruch Hashem, it has. With the help of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Agudas Achim Synagogue has become a mayan from which many have begun to draw their spiritual identity, growing more and more each day, meeting the challenge of Losala v'mala Sondas B'chei. May our synagogue, as well as others like it, continue the Hadir Torah u'Hadira, continue to be a vehicle for spiritual and halakha growth in the years ahead.
Take some questions.
Appreciate both of your presentations very much. Very moving, very meaningful. I ask you about finances, though. You know, all of this is an expensive undertaking. It's certainly something can be done without money, but nothing can really move, I'm sure you would both admit, without the funding to print and to distribute and to advertise and to, I mean, and everything that applies. I assume you're both fortunate to have members who back you.
Actually, I'm independent as well.
Could you talk about finances a little bit? That clearly is one of the keys to this.
Well, first of all, we had a little bit of a discussion yesterday, but I haven't been in my synagogue as long as Rebbe Senior has been in his, but before I came there, I made a deal with them that my contract was not only to include what my salary was going to be, but I asked them to set up several thousand dollars aside for programming. And when my contract comes to be renewed again, I will do the same thing, and that is that that part and parcel of them wanting me to stay in the synagogue will have to be that as the membership has grown, that they have to increase their funding of those types of programs. Now, at the same time, while Baruch Hashem, we've also seen a tremendous growth. The shul has gone from 80 to 160 families in 1 year, and unfortunately, the expenses haven't kept up are a lot higher than the income, especially when you have very young families moving into the community. So especially the first few years, they have tremendous expenses just putting a down payment and all the other expenses of moving. I have taken it upon myself to make sure that in addition to what the synagogue will put aside, that I try to set appeals aside throughout the year that just go to programming, like the Yisker appeal. And the shul, I just set aside for programs. And any income that comes from those appeals goes into a special fund that's only used for adult education. Another thing that I have done is we have a computer-generated list of Yiskers. Now, if somebody has Yisker around the time when you're running your program, you can go over to them and say, listen, for $250, which is not a lot of money, all right, which is not a lot of money, and they don't have to even pay it all one at a time if they can, we'll dedicate this program in memory of your loved one. Now, $250 will pay for the printing of your flyers. It will pay for, it might even pay for an ad in the paper. And if you can not go to one person, but go to two or three people, to sponsor that program, then you need to put together $750 for it. And I think another thing is that I created a publicity committee in my shul, and they met with all the press people, and you'd be surprised about the non-for-profit deals that they have. For example, we have a major paper in South Florida called the Sun Sentinel. I would say, from a New York perspective, it's like number two after the Miami Herald. So it's like whatever number two is after the New York Times. So what we did was, they said, you know, on Wednesdays and Sundays, we have a special deal for nonprofits. We'll give you a half a page for $200. So yesterday we ran, we're doing Turn for an End to Shabbos next week. So for $200, we ran an ad, a half a page, in the Sun Sentinel about Turn for an End to Shabbos. I spoke to my secretary yesterday afternoon. She said that she already got 60 phone calls from that one ad. Now, you have to know how to spend money effectively. We don't have, you know, we can't do what these guys do, that they send out 4,000, 5,000 things, and they just chant them, and after spending $1 million, they know their market. We have to, you know, we have to be more cost-effective and more fiscally responsible. But you will find that there are radio programs that will give you free ad time. You'll find that there are newspapers that will do special things for you. You'll find that if you ask one of these editors how to write a press release, they'll be more than willing to show your publicity committee how to write a press release. And if they follow up after you send out a press release, you'll find that they also will put them in. So you can get a lot of free publicity. So I think there's a mixture of ways to deal with the financial crunch. And you have to decide which market you're interested in. I'm not interested, I know it might sound condescending some way, but I'm not interested right now in the older community in Florida. First of all, Boca is not an old community, and there's more than enough programs for them. I'm interested in the young yuppie, the 80,000, there are 80,000 Jews in Boca and Del Rey. Only 15% of them are affiliated with any synagogue. I'm interested in that group when I talk about outreach. And when it comes to inreach, you know, that is more on a personal basis. The publicity committee also has a phone squad. You can have the greatest program in the world, but if people are not followed up with a phone call, they're not going to come to programs. And we make sure that before any substantial program, we make sure that there are phone calls that go out. And so I think, you know, that is publicity that is, you know, almost costs nothing. And you have to make sure that you use those avenues, which you can get nice exposure that are pretty cheap, and, you know, through that, you know, maximize your dollars.
So I just want to add briefly to what Kenny has said, and actually piggyback on his remarks, and that is that I think priorities are very important. And whereas every synagogue in our community has involved themselves in a building campaign since I've come, we have not. And it's not because I have no sense of the aesthetic, nor is it because we do not need the room. But I've been more interested in having my Baal Batim know that the monies that are there, because even if you have wealthy Baal Batim, there's just a limited amount of money that they're going to give and designate to the synagogue. I prefer that they use that money towards programming. And I didn't mention that we've had many Baals and residents coming in as well. Of course that costs money. In order to do that, of course, I have to cut back on certain other things.
Thank you, Smith. We have a Dean Steinbelt coming. Now, my board wanted to charge $5 a person for him to come. We'll have 550 people at the Saturday night lecture. But what one of the person in charge of the program said, we're not going to charge a penny. But at the end of the program, we're going to ask people to donate. You know, at the end of the program, we're not going to pass it on the hat, but we'll ask people to donate. I'm willing to bet that we'll bring in more money that way than we would have brought if we charged $5. I think that you can do that at the end of a good program. You can say it costs money to bring in a scholar and resident. If you'd like to donate something, and you make sure that you tell people to take out their checkbooks instead of throwing in you know, you don't do it yourself. I don't think it's the role of the rabbi to be a public fundraiser. We all know that behind the scenes, a rabbi has to orchestrate certain things. But I do think that you have to do effective fundraising and learn how to do that.
Alan, I just wanted to ask you, out of 600 or so over the years of you members you've gotten, where do the majority of them come from? Unaffiliated people in the community or from other synagogues?
Excellent question. Many of them have come from other synagogues.
my colleagues still like me, but they're not always that happy with me. And also the unaffiliated people who moved into the community. But most of them are not people who come from an Orthodox background. As a matter of fact, you know, that works somewhat against us, because when somebody moves into the community, their immediate reaction is not just to see themselves as joining an Orthodox community. And they always come to me and tell me that, and then I try and indicate that they can feel comfortable. So most of them have been unaffiliated as well.
So how do you, I don't know if you could give me an example. Yesterday, Ruben brought up the point, you know, how have you successfully been able to get those people past the machitza issue that they may have feel are uncomfortable about sitting?
I think that it's a matter of one-on-one, sitting down with people, and they started to involve themselves in the process. It's interesting, the woman is more excited than the husband in this case, though he is, or comes from a firmer background than she. And she was very, at first, very uncomfortable talking about it. You know, we were getting into the real stuff, and how difficult it is for him to withhold during those periods of time, and da 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 da. But again, it's a matter of, and I think that's why I mentioned the issue of the individual. More important than anything else is the one-on-one contact with each person. And it does take a lot of time, and it requires a lot of effort. But, you know, the secret message is overwhelming.
I have two questions. Number one, in both cases, you are dealing mostly with people who move into the community. Is that correct? Most of the new people that you get online is basically that. Mine's a mixture of both. I'm getting people to the service, and some from the actually from the Reform Shul also. Or need jobs.
or need jobs, and you know the recession hasn't been as bad in the South as it has been in the North, and therefore you know there's a lot of movement for young people. Yeah.
Mine is also a mix. If you recall in my remarks, I mentioned that what was happening was the membership of our congregation was dwindling, meaning that our congregation was over 100 years old. A lot of the children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren were leaving. Many of those people have now come back. They were leaving and joining the conservative Reform Congregation. Did they come back?
Did they move into your district, your area, or most of the people that you involved in your programs, are there people who moved into your area, or are
not necessarily?
Not necessarily. And one more question around my center. What was the first thing you did?
I mean, I hope it's a theme. I walked through the door. Actually, the first thing I did when I walked through the door was, though I had known that the synagogue was in trouble, I saw that they had a nursery school, and that was wonderful. I went up and played duck, duck, goose with the kids. But that just is an indication that you have to deal with people on every level, whether it's the children or whether it's the adults, whether it's an intense Gemara shiur. I have people who come to my Talmud shiur who have a wonderful background and some who do not. But I think what one has to do in a congregation that has such a diverse membership is to integrate everybody together.
I give around 9 a week. I teach Monday nights. I give one private one to doctors, and then I give another one except at 10 o'clock at night. Tuesday, I teach two at the Federation for beginners. One has around 40 people in it, one has around 10 or 15. Wednesday night, I teach one at someone's home, and then give an advance. I'm very fortunate that I have two other retired rabbis in the shul. One teaches the beginner's Talmud, one teaches intermediate, and I teach an advanced shiur. And people, you have to prepare Gemara Rashi places before you walk into the shiur. And I don't, and I make that a rule. And if you don't prepare Gemara Rashi places before you walk into the shiur, you'll be lost in the shiur. We just do, you know, Rishonim. So I give a shiur on Wednesday night. Thursday night, my wife said if I teach, I shouldn't bother coming back home. Then Friday night I give one class, and Shabbos I give one Chumash class to the entire shul.
Three children. When do you do your own learning?
Wednesdays I don't go into the shul. Wednesdays I just sit home alone.
How
did
you spend time on your own shul?
Well, I make sure that I go home. Well, most of my classes are after.
Is it a minute schedule?
Well, it's fine. First of all, thank God I have a good relationship with my kids. My kids are pretty young still. My oldest is 4 and a half. I made sure that I'm home at least twice a week for supper, to play with them. I make sure that I put them to bed at least once or twice a week. But they go to bed by 7 o'clock, and most of my classes start after that time.
My children, they did not like to be put on exhibition. They didn't want the Balabakan coming over to the house and shopping. A set of rules. That the Balabakan could come any night when we were excluding Shabbos, because that's the time that my kids have to come. Not only that, but the only people that were allowed to be here were my children's friends.
But we have a rule that Friday night we don't have any guests, but Shabbos we do. And I have one advantage, and that is that I'm the son of a rabbi. And I remember in my smicha class, we took a vote. I think there was only two children of rabbis in our whole class. And I had a very good role model. And my father learned, and he's principal of a very big school, and he was a rabbi in the shul. You know, he explained that there's a balance. And my father did not tuck me into bed every single night. And he wasn't there for every single supper. But he was there at least once or twice a week to eat with us. He always learned with me on Shabbos, and my kid is 4 and a half years old, but I always learn with them on Shabbos. We do the Aleph Beis, a few other things. And I believe that if you create special times for them, and they know that those special times are for them, that that's very good. But at the same time, I also believe that in the home, we didn't have to get 2 weeks. My wife invited, we had 300 people Simchas Torah for lunch in our backyard. We have a very large backyard. And we didn't have guests for like 2 weeks before that because I just didn't want anyone in the house. It was Shabbos. My son asked me Shabbos day that if it's Shabbos, how come there are no guests at the table? That Abba, it must not really be Shabbos. And I happen to think there's something very beautiful that they know that they have a Shabbos party for themselves, that Friday night, that it could be, no matter who it is, you know, if Din Steinsaltz comes to the community, he's not coming to my house Friday night. But at the same time, I do think that part of being a rabbi, if you want, you know, there is a certain amount of sacrifice involved. And I think that anyone is fooling themselves if they don't think that that's part of the process. But you have to create a balance. And if you create that balance, I think that you can guarantee a very strong family environment and a very strong community. And I'm blessed with a wife that will kick me in the pants. And,
I give six shiurim during the week, as well as I do a lot of private study. Eishet Torah come into our community and work along very well, but they have kind of developed in certain people this elitist idea of studying, you know, one-on-one or two-on-one with the Rav. So out of necessity, in addition to regular shiurim that I get during the week, I have to do some private study with people who want that to meet. They're during the week, two at night, one in the afternoon, and two in the morning, and one on Shabbat afternoon.
And your own study?
A lot of my study involves preparation for the shiur.
When do you do that? Whenever you can.
2 in the morning. I'm not asleep this time, but you know, it's difficult, it isn't easy, but it can be done. I'll take this first. I don't think, and there certainly is not, it's not even a matter of thinking, there's no game plan in terms of getting the members of other congregations. That's not what I'm about, nor would I do it. I think that for whatever reason, as a result of the outreach program, some of the lunches downtown that I have, people will come who are affiliated with other congregations and suddenly feel good about what they've been exposed to. But there's certainly no plan to go out and get members of other shuls. You are correct that sometimes rabbis will be a little put off and think, well, hey, look, you know, this rabbi's raiding our synagogue. But it's really not true. And I think what you also have to be able and willing to do is to accept the fact that sometimes what you offer is not going to appeal to everyone. On the downside, I will share with you that right before Rosh Hashanah, I received two calls from two young couples who have children, and they said that they were leaving the synagogue, that they felt very good about me, they loved me, but were not able to continue because of the women's issue. They had daughters, and they wanted their daughters to be able to do what their sons could do. So what I'm saying is, this is all, you know, part of what it's about. By the same token, there are folks who will come to my shiurim and suddenly realize that halacha is the vehicle that they want rather than compromising Jewish law. So I don't think there's any set pattern. You do what you can do, you do it well, and then people are either attracted or do not buy into it.
Thank you.
I think that, that most of the people that I've gotten from other synagogues have come not through programs that run in the shul, but through my involvement at the JCC and other things. That I teach at, there's a Milton mini school in Boca, and that is that Florence Milton had worked with the Hebrew University to set up a two-year program so that people who have no background whatsoever can learn at the JCCs what Judaism is about. It happens to be a very good curriculum. So I teach the first and second year students at that Milton school. It's not a synagogue atmosphere, and people have, from that program, have come into Boca Raton Synagogue. And also, I believe that programs like Turn Friday Night into Shabbos can bring in people from other synagogues. I believe that the program that the National Jewish Outreach Program has, they have a Intro to Judaism, a five-part course, which deals with belief in God, Shabbos, sexuality, prayer, and doing functional mitzvot. I think that that is an extremely good program, and I think that you can advertise it in a way, in other words, there are common grounds. You know, there are supermarkets that everyone goes to. You can, you know, put big posters there. There are papers that everyone reads. There are press releases that everyone's going to see. There's a Federation campus, which everyone will also, or many people will be at. And I think that those are the ways you create those types of programs. I have someone that called me right before.
Okay, just take a look.
Yeah, I enjoyed your talk yesterday about marketing.
Thank you.
Any questions about Biden?
That's tough.